Susan Gravy, Ken did lay those out in his testimony, I believe, on page 4, 5, 6, and 7.
Okay. Senator Harbor?
We're going to talk to that a little. Can you give your testimony, those deviations?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah, and let me just tell you, the paradigm that I'm operating under, we're all, with the exception of Mr. Courtney, Senator Courtney, not attorneys here. So in that sense, we represent the private citizens who are subject to the UCC. So my thinking is we ought to understand this. And Senator Courtney tells me that this was an area of law that didn't necessarily specialize in. So,
no.
So no, what I'm hoping to do is go section by section by section, and it's not that we have to understand the intricacies or nuances of all of these things as it relates in the business world. We don't want to get into the complexity of all that, but we do want to have at least a rudimentary understanding of what those things are and how they affect the world of business and private citizens. So when you get really, really, really sick of this, raise your hand and we'll move the bill. Not what we don't want to do is what one legislator did one time, was quoting the press saying that it's the last time they're going to vote on a bill. I don't understand. So even though this is very, very complex, at some point somebody's going to point to you and say, what did you do here? So we need to have at least a reasonable explanation as to what we did. Any other questions, comments?
Mr. Chair, just an admin question. If this date is effective, do we have to have an emergency clause in here?
I think it has one, doesn't it?
Is it in there someplace?
There is an emergency clause.
Okay.
At the end.
Okay. Who's next?
Senator Minnis, members of the committee, this is Susan Gravy, and I was just going to touch on the work group process, the participants involved in the process, and the bar's role. I'll go through that briefly, and if you have any questions, feel free to ask. This bill started out with a work group that was formed in November of 1999 at the request of a number of different people. The Uniform State Laws Commissioners were very interested in having this enacted in the state of Oregon, as was the financial lending community, and a number of bar groups were very interested. So we formed a work group in November of 1999 to sit down and try and work through the procedural aspects of the bill and also the policy issues that were presented. The work group was not exclusive. We invited everybody and anybody who wanted to attend. We had approximately 40 members on our roster who received the information on a monthly basis. We did meet monthly as a full work group and had a different subcommittee set up that met in between work group meetings. Those subcommittees consisted of filing fee issues for the Secretary of State, agricultural lien issues, consumer law issues, and a subcommittee dealing with miscellaneous issues, including the accessions issue, which came up, and the municipal finance and bonding company issues. So there was a lot of work that was done in between the work group meetings on a monthly basis. And after a year, we finally put it to rest. I think the entire work group was aiming towards making sure that we had a work product that was completed and could be pre-session filed and introduced for the 2001 session. And that was in large part, due to the deadline. The entire nation is supposed to be operating under the new revised UCC Article 9 as of July 2001. So that's part of our push to move forward with the bill.
Senator Beyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm a farmer. I'm a pretty simple person. I work on a volume basis. Anytime we're going to add 198 new chapters to law, I like to make sure we're removing at least 198 chapters. I see Section 187. I'm assuming that's the part that takes out the old UCC. So, thank you. Is it? Would those pages be this thick?
You never know for sure.
If I could just offer a rough observation about that. We currently have a version of Article 9 on the books. It is being repealed at the same time that this is being enacted. The overall volume of section numbers is larger in the new bill. That's partially due simply, though, to a rewriting, a subdividing of what used to be long and dense sections, to making them more accessible and individual. On the other hand, there is more detail in the new bill. generally because the transaction of business, the extending of large loans, requires a large degree of certainty on the part of lenders. And the more certainty we have, the more we spell things out in the statute, the more helpful that is.
Thank you. Okay. Anything else?
To continue, just to list some of the people who were involved in the work group, we had the Oregon Bankers Association, Credit Union League, County Clerks Association, Secretary of State's Office, Les Schwab, Municipal and Finance and Bonding Representatives, Agricultural Cooperative Council, Oregon Collectors Association and Mortgage Bankers, Financial Services Association, and that's just a few. We had some bar groups involved, the consumer law section and the debtor-creditor law section. So there were a number of participants in the process, although we did kind of narrow down towards the end. There were fewer involved when it came down to doing the real work. We did operate on a consensus basis so that anything that came out, there were a number of policy issues that were presented, and it was a matter of the work group saying if it's too controversial an issue and we're going to leave that to the legislature to decide and we're not going to include it in the bill. So what you see is a consensus draft. We tracked on existing Oregon law and existing version of UCC Article 9 that was adopted in Oregon in 1972, I believe. And I guess the last thing I'll say is that the Oregon State Bar's Public Affairs Committee, which is our legislative arm, did meet on Saturday and reiterated its support for the interim process that this work group went through, and that conceptually they support the bill. They did want to make sure that you were aware that not all bar groups were involved in the process, and because we are a mandatory bar, there could be other comments or concerns raised by other bar groups as the draft moves through the process at this time, but we're here to say that the Public Affairs Committee supports the conceptual bill, SB 171, as it stands right now.
Okay. If I understand correctly, what you're telling me is Senate Bill 171 is the core of the areas that everyone consented to. They all said, for the most part, this is what we can live with. But there were other areas that people had disagreements over. Is that correct?
That is correct.
Can you identify the areas that they disagreed and that were perhaps left out of the bill?
Well, I think probably Ken and Carl might want to cover those in more detail than I would do. But, for example, there were subcommittees set up on filing issues for the Secretary of State's office, for some of the consumer law issues, and the governmental transfer exclusion for the municipal finance bonding companies, as well as agricultural liens. And those are all areas, not all of them, but, for example, some of those areas will be dealt with outside of Article 9.
No dealt with outside of Article 9, but they come under the purview of Article 9.
Some of them do, and that's a whole other area, yes.
In other words, you guys didn't want to go there. You just need this core thing accomplished. Okay. I'm trying to get the gist of this. I think you want to get the core of this bill passed, and you offloaded some things that you couldn't come to agreement with in order to hopefully have this thing in place by...
Yes. Chairman, as members of the committee, I think that's accurate.
Okay.
For example, the agricultural liens issues, the law in Oregon is different, and so the committee felt that they did not want to deal with it in this bill, work out those policy issues, and so they decided just not to deal with the majority of that,
mm-hmm.
as well as some of the consumer issues. Other areas were changed, but as a general rule, the bill presents a consensus bill of the work group.
Okay. Good. I think I get it. Ken, are you on now?
I am indeed, Mr. Chairman.
Okay, sir.
Chairman, members of the committee, I'm Ken Sherman, Jr. I'm the general counsel for the Oregon Bankers Association. And along with 30 or 40 other individuals, I had the privilege of serving the last 14 or 15 months on the work group that Susan has described. It was put together to take this NCUSL draft of revised Article 9 and put it into bill form for introduction here in Oregon. I want to begin by saying formally that the OBA supports the enactment of this very important measure. My testimony this afternoon will fall into three parts. First, an overview of Article 9. Secondly, a description of what we believe are the most important changes that revised Article 9 would make from our current form of that article. And finally, highlights of the changes that our work group recommends from the revised uniform draft. Now, Professor Beer has described the UCC and the central role that it plays in our commercial law, and I think it's fair to say that Article 9 may be, in some ways, the most important article in the Uniform Commercial Code. You think about it, most of us have mortgages on our houses, we have loans on our automobiles. The availability of credit, both for business and consumers, allows us to acquire, use, and enjoy things that we could never afford to pay for right now with cash. Credit fuels our economy to an unprecedented degree today, and not incidentally, it gives the banks that I represent in the OBA a reason for their being. Article 9 provides the legal framework within which credit may be extended to businesses and consumers on a secured basis using the debtor's personal property as the security. To understand Article 9, it's helpful to define some key terms. I've already referred to the term personal property. By that I mean anything that isn't land or something permanently attached to land. Automobiles, books, computers, this table are all examples of personal property. The other major category of property is real property, and that's land and things like this building that are permanently attached to land. When we talk about Article 9, we're generally focusing on personal property. But personal property isn't limited to things that we can touch and see. There are also intangible forms of personal property. For example, if I owe your business money for a service your business has performed, to your business, that debt that I owe to it constitutes an account receivable. And accounts receivable are one form of intangible personal property. Another important concept in understanding Article 9 is the idea of different interests in property and the fact that two or more interests can exist at the same time in the same piece of property. This is true for both real and personal property, but again, when we talk about Article 9, we're focusing on personal property. For example, if you rent a car from Avis, for the time that you have that automobile, both you and Avis have interests in it. Avis owns the car, and that gives them one set of legal rights, but you are the lessee of the car. You have a leasehold interest. That's another separate set of legal rights and obligations. And there may, in fact, be a third interest in that rental car. Let's assume that Avis was short of cash when it purchased the car for its rental fleet. So it went to the bank or some other lender, and it borrowed the money to fund the purchase. Now, the bank thinks Avis is a good, strong company that will be able and willing to repay the loan, but to protect itself and to comply with the banking laws, the bank wants some security for Avis's promise to repay. So Avis gives the bank what we call a security interest in that car. Security interest is probably the most important term in Article 9. And interestingly enough, while there are more than 100 terms defined in various places in Article 9, security interest isn't one of them. The definition for security interest is so important that the Nicuzel folks put it back in Article 1, which we're not amending this session. That's the first article of the Uniform Commercial Code. And security interest means an interest in personal property or fixtures which secures payment or performance of an obligation. Pretty simple definition. Article 9, then, is the rule book on personal property security interests, how to establish them, how to give them priority over other interests in the same property, how to extend the periods of their effectiveness, how to enforce them, and how to terminate them when they're no longer needed. Before we get into the details of Article 9, there are a few other key terms that we need to define. Creditor. That's a term that's not used in or defined in Article 9, but it's a term I'm going to use here today. By creditor, I mean someone to whom an obligation is owed. This may be an obligation to pay money or to perform some other act. Debtor, on the other hand, means a person who owns or has some lesser interest in personal property that is being used as collateral to secure a debt or other obligation. Now, usually, the debtor will be the person who owes the debt or the obligation to the creditor. But in some cases, such as where a parent puts up security for a child's obligation. The collateral is owned by person A, the parent, and is used to secure the debt of person B, the child. In such a case, Article 9 refers to person B, the child, who's borrowing the money, as the obligor. To keep things simple in this testimony, I'm going to just use the term debtor throughout. Another term is security agreement. That's an agreement that creates or provides for a security interest. Typically, this agreement is between the creditor and the debtor. When the creditor and debtor enter into a security agreement and take the steps that are required for attachment of the security interest under Article 9, the creditor obtains a security interest in the items of the debtor's personal property that are described in the security agreement. And when that happens, the creditor becomes a secured party. That's a term that Article 9 uses over and over. And the identified items of the debtor's property become collateral for the payment or performance of the secured obligation. Once a security interest attaches to the collateral, it's effective and enforceable as between the secured party and the debtor. But for the secured party, that's not really enough. The secured party knows that there may be other creditors of the debtor out there, either a creditor to whom the debtor has given a competing security interest in the same collateral, or a creditor who's gotten a judgment against the debtor, which judgment has become a lien against the debtor's property. If the debtor defaults on the obligation to the secured party wants to make sure that its security interest in the collateral will win out over a competing security interest or lien in that same collateral. In the language of Article 9, our secured party wants its security interest to have priority over competing interests. The secured party wants to be first in line with respect to the collateral if the debtor doesn't pay or perform the obligation. Or in some cases, the secured party may be content to be second or third in line, but doesn't want somebody else to be able to jump in front after the secured party has obtained its security interest in the debtor's collateral. To protect its priority position, then, vis-a-vis other creditors, Article 9 provides rules under which the secured party can perfect, another important word, perfect its security interest in the debtor's collateral. Perfection is an extremely important concept under Article 9. The purpose of perfection is not only to establish the relative priority of your own security interest, but also to let third parties know of it so that they can act accordingly in their dealings with the debtor. The Article 9 rules on perfection are designed to give third parties a reasonable opportunity to find out that you have a security interest in the debtor's property so that the third party won't take such an interest under the false assumption that the collateral is free and clear. Perfection can be accomplished in several different ways, depending on the type of collateral involved, and I'll have more to say on that later. So, just to kind of summarize, to secure the payment or performance of various kinds of obligations, we have debtors who are giving security interests in their personal property to creditors, thereby turning the creditor into a secured party. The debtor's property becomes collateral. The security interest attaches to the collateral when it becomes effective under the terms of the security agreement and the rules of Article 9. And in order to establish priority of that security interest vis-a-vis other creditors, the secured party must perfect its interest by following the rules of Article 9. As I said a minute ago, perfection of the security interest is accomplished in several different ways, depending on the type of collateral. The most common way of perfecting your security interest is to file what's called a financing statement in the appropriate public record. This will work for most, but not all types of collateral. Filing a financing statement covering personal property is analogous to recording a mortgage or a trust deed against the debtor's real property. One case where filing a financing statement won't work to perfect the security interest is where the collateral is covered by a certificate of title, such as a car or a boat. A security interest in that kind of collateral can generally be perfected only by having the security interest noted on that certificate of title. A second exception to the general rule of perfecting by filing is that for some types of collateral, the security interest can only be perfected by taking control of the collateral. An example is a security interest in the debtor's bank account, and that's a new area of coverage for Article 9. That's one of the ways this article differs from the current form. Given the way that people use their bank accounts, it wouldn't be practical to perfect security interests in them by filing. So the creditor has to take what the Article 9 calls control over the account, and revised Article 9 defines the means and lays out the rules for accomplishing that control. A third exception to the perfection by filing rule is that for some types of collateral, the secured party may perfect its interest by taking physical possession of the property itself. This is, for example, the only way to perfect a security interest in the debtor's cash money. For some other types of collateral, possession is just one alternative for perfecting the security interest. Once the security interest is perfected, regardless of how that happens, the parties have accomplished their goal of creating a secured transaction, and we wait to see whether the debtor will pay or perform as per the agreement between the parties. If all goes well, when the obligation is satisfied, the security interest is terminated, and Article 9 provides rules on how that is accomplished and establishes the consequences for failing to terminate the interest. If, on the other hand, the debtor defaults on the payment or performance of the secured obligation, Article 9 details the steps that the secured party can take to apply the collateral to the satisfaction of the obligation. It also provides protections for the debtor and third parties to ensure that the secured party doesn't overreach and treat the debtor or others unfairly, and to establish sanctions where the secured party violates the provisions of Article 9. So that's the general structure of Article 9. As Professor Beer testified, Article 9 has been a part of our law as ORS Chapter 79 since our UCC was enacted here in Oregon in 1961. Some of its sections have been amended since then, but most of them have not really changed in the last 40 years. Several years ago, I guess about 10 years ago, the National Conference of Commissioners on Uniform State Laws decided it was time to draft an updated version of Article 9. They've earlier done this with other articles, and those of you who have been here for several sessions may remember back in 1993, for example, we passed widespread amendments to Articles 3 and 4 of the Uniform Commercial Code. In rewriting Article 9, NCUSL sought to accomplish several things. First, they wanted to expand the scope of the article so that it would cover additional kinds of personal property, such as the debtor's interest in a bank account. They wanted to change some of the rules for perfecting security interests, such as where a financing statement should be filed and how control is established over collateral such as deposit accounts. They wanted to simplify and to centralize state filing systems for filing the financing statements and related documents, and to encourage electronic filing. They wanted to enhance the rights of debtors in consumer transactions. They wanted to establish new rules for enforcement of security interests, and they wanted generally to modernize and better organize the provisions of Article 9. Revised Article 9 accomplishes each of these goals. The scope of the article is enlarged by making it applicable to new kinds of debtors' property, such as deposit accounts and health care insurance receivables, and making it applicable to additional kinds of transactions, such as sales of payment intangibles and promissory notes. Revised Article 9 fleshes out the concept of perfecting a security interest by taking control of collateral. The new article is clearer on what constitutes control and how it is obtained, and the use of control to perfect the security interest is expanded from just investment property, such as stocks in a company, that's the current rule under Article 9, to cover other property interests, such as a debtor's rights under a letter of credit or a deposit account. Reflecting the increasingly interstate nature of our commerce, revised Article 9 makes two important changes from current Article 9 regarding the place to file a financing statement in interstate transactions. First, under current Article 9, the law of the state in which the collateral is located. Where's the security? Is it in Oregon? Is it in Idaho? The state in which the collateral is located will govern the perfection and priority of the security interest under our current law. Under revised Article 9, the law of the state in which the debtor is located will govern perfection and priority. And it's my understanding that Nkuzel made that change because in our modern economy, it is more likely that the location of collateral will change more frequently than the location of the debtor. Secondly, under current Article 9, the location of a business debtor is determined by the location of the debtor's chief executive office. Under the new article, if a business debtor is a registered organization, that's a defined term, such as a corporation or a limited liability company, its location will be the state in which it is created by registration. Revised Article 9 provides that most financing statements will be filed in a single office in each state. For Oregon, that is the Office of the Secretary of State. Centralized filing simplifies the process that third parties have to go through to obtain information on what, if any, other security interests may exist in a given debtor's property. Revised Article 9 also contains provisions designed to facilitate paperless electronic filing of financing statements. For example, the revised rules eliminate the requirement that the debtor sign the financing statement. They also establish clear rules under which filing offices are to accept or reject records for filing. Many Article 9 transactions involve consumers, either because a consumer owes payment or performance on the secured obligation, or because the collateral that secures that obligation is consumer goods, that is, goods that are used primarily for personal, family, or household purposes. Revised Article 9 enhances the protections that are provided to consumers in several ways. It provides that a consumer debtor may not waive the right to redeem the collateral following default. All debtors have the right to redeem, but only in non-consumer transactions may the debtor effectively waive or give up this right. It entitles consumers to specific disclosure of the consumer's right to recover any surplus resulting from a disposition of collateral, as well as the right of the secured party to obtain a deficiency. Now, let me stop and explain what I'm talking about here. Let's say that the collateral is anything, a desk, a truck, anything, and the debt is $500, and there's a default in the payment on that debt, so the creditor, the secured party, repossesses that item and sells it. If they sell it for $300, you've got a $200 deficiency. That's what I mean by a deficiency. If you get a surplus, if they sell it for more, then there's a right on the part of the debtor to recover that surplus. What I'm saying here is that one of the new protections for consumers is that revised Article 9 requires specific disclosure to the consumer of the right to recover any surplus or the liability that the debtor will have for any deficiency. The consumer also has the right to receive from the secured party an explanation of how any surplus or any deficiency was determined. New statutory damages are provided for consumers where the secured party fails to comply with specific requirements in Article 9, where the collateral is sold to the secured party or someone related to the secured party following default, any surplus or deficiency will be measured not by the price that was obtained through that close quarters sale, but rather from the price that would have been obtained in an arm's-length transaction. Let me just give you an example of what we're talking about there. Let's say that I'm the creditor and I have repossessed the collateral and I'm going to sell it. Rather than selling it on the open market in an arm's-length transaction and getting full value for it, I turn around and I sell it for something less than full value to someone who is in some sense related to me. Maybe a subsidiary of my corporation, or maybe a relative if I'm acting in my individual capacity. I sell it to somebody and it's basically a sweetheart deal. Mm-hmm. What this says is that in that situation, if there's any deficiency that the debtor is going to owe for the difference between the debt that was owed and the sale price that I got on the sale, it's going to be measured not by what I got in that sweetheart sale. It's going to be measured by what I should have gotten in an arm's length sale. Additional protection for the consumer.
How's that determination made?
How is which determination made?
Who determines that it's a sweetheart deal? And
well, there are actually fairly detailed rules in Part 6 of the of Article 9 to determine who has the burden of proof. What would happen in that situation is basically that the consumer would come in and say, that's a sweetheart deal. And then it puts the creditor on, it gives the creditor the burden of proving either that it wasn't a sweetheart deal or...
They go to complain.
To the court.
To the court. Yeah. So they'd have to file some kind of a...
That's correct.
Technically, I suppose the borrower wouldn't need to initiate the suit. Ordinarily, what Ken is describing is that the collateral didn't fetch enough to pay off the debt altogether, so there's a deficiency, and that means the lender would be suing the borrower to recover that deficiency. So the borrower is already in court, and the borrower can simply raise it as a defense, oh, I don't owe this the deficiency, or at least it's not as big, because the secured creditor, they misbehaved. They shouldn't have carried out this sweetheart deal.
Okay. Anybody else?
Revised Article 9 clarifies that in consumer transactions, the secured party can't retain the collateral in partial satisfaction of the obligation. And finally, with respect to both consumer and non-consumer transactions, revised Article 9 imposes on parties a new objective good faith requirement. The standard there is honesty in fact and observance of reasonable commercial standards of fair dealing. With regard to enforcement of security interests, the new rules require secured parties to notify secondary obligors, someone who's guaranteed the debt, for example, when there has been a default on the obligation. Another new section provides that when a secured party causes repossessed collateral to be sold to satisfy the secured debt, the sale will carry with it the same warranties of title and the like that are a part of any other sale. Revised Article 9 also broadens the obligation of a secured party who repossesses and disposes of collateral to notify other secured parties and lien holders who have interests in the same collateral so that they can take appropriate steps to protect their interests. Finally, NCUSL has accomplished its goal of improving upon the organization of Article 9. The revised article is organized into six parts, which are, I think, roughly follow the chronological life, if you will, of a security interest. Part 1 defines key terms that are used in the article and explains general concept. Part 2 covers the effectiveness of security agreements, the attachment of security interests, and the rights of parties to security agreements. Part 3 establishes the rules for perfection and priority of security interests. Part 4 deals with the rights of third parties who are affected by a secured transaction. Part 5 lays down the rules of for the operation of the filing system. And Part 6 contains the provisions dealing with the debtor's default, the enforcement of the security interest, along with rules governing the noncompliance with the requirements of the article. We prepared and submit for your record, and I believe you have, a couple of documents that I hope will assist you in your review of this very complex piece of legislation. The first is a table of contents. I think it's about 5 or 6 pages, very small type, but my version is 18 pages, and I wanted to spare you that. Table of contents that simply lists every section and subsection in the bill, and it's a good aid to finding what you're looking for in the bill and helps you to understand how the bill is organized and laid out. The second piece is a section-by-section summary and analysis of the bill. It is simply our best effort to this point to try and say in somewhat clearer and more concise language what the bill says on a section-by-section basis. And I apologize for its length as well. I think it's out there at about 70 pages, which is a lot of words, but this is a very complex piece of legislation, and so we just made it as succinct as possible. We also ask that you make
NCUSL's...
Excuse me.
Senator Byers' question.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. On page 6 of your testimony, you mentioned that one of the things this new Article 9 does is the changes location of a business debtor. Knowing that most large corporations and many not so large corporations are filed in Delaware as their place of organization, does this also apply to creditors? Because this could lead a lot of people to have to go to Delaware then to file suit or to be involved in a suit if it applies to that.
If I may, Senator Beyer, that's a very interesting question that a colleague of mine, a professor who's now at UCLA Law School, has done some empirical study on. The question of Delaware being the home of all of these businesses is something he thought about. In reality, yes, the Fortune 500 corporations, the very large enterprises, tend to be incorporated in Delaware. But those corporations are generally not debtors in secured transactions. They have such excellent credit that they can borrow all the money they need from bondholders or other people that don't need collateral. And then you go down from that level to the vast majority of businesses that are existing in the country, and they tend to be incorporated where they do business. There are, just for matters of legal convenience and having access to the relevant state offices and so on, businesses that are operating in Oregon tend to be incorporated in Oregon and so on throughout the nation. So that this change, empirically, we don't think it's going to lead to sort of lopsided change in filing. One other thing to think about, you may occasionally have a business that's operating in Oregon but is incorporated in Washington or somewhere, could be Delaware, certainly. One of the changes that Article 9 is making is to explicitly enable electronic filing of financing statements, so that, yes, for a Washington-organized business, a creditor here would need to file a financing statement with the Washington Secretary of State. However, that can be done electronically now, so that the geography shouldn't be a problem.
Thank you.
Does the draft allow a choice of law by the debtors or creditors as part of the agreement?
I'm sorry.
Does Bill 171 allow a choice of law by the debtor or the creditor as part of their agreement?
Yes, it does. It's always been a general principle of the Uniform Commercial Code to allow freedom of contract to the parties. People who are voluntarily entering into a business deal can choose the terms of their deal. And one of the terms they might very well want to choose is what law governs this deal. Are we going to be governed by Oregon law, by Washington law, or whatever? Now, however, that freedom of choice is allowed to bind only the two parties who have signed the deal, the borrower and the lender. It's not allowed to, for common sense will tell you, it's not allowed to bind third parties, strangers to the deal. And as a part of that common sense limitation, the rules on where to perfect a security interest are not subject to contractual choice by the parties. Right? The whole point of the perfection and the filing is to put third parties on notice.
If I may just add, I think the reason that we see this kind of change in revised Article 9 is because the drafters wanted to give the whole world more certainty as to where to go to look to find these security interests. You want, if you're thinking about extending credit to an individual, or more likely to a company, you need to be able to go and look in the records to see what's already there. That's part of your due diligence in determining whether it's prudent for you to advance this additional credit. The current law says, well, it's a chief executive office, and that's kind of that's not a very well defined term, and it may mean different things to different people in different states who are trying to figure this out. But there's not going to be any question about where a corporation is or other registered organization is organized. It's organized under the law of Delaware or Oregon or wherever it's going to be, but there's only one of those. So the reason for that kind of change is to make this work better by bringing more certainty into the rules. Yeah, because as Professor Beer said, The reason that we file these things, these financing statements, is to let the rest of the world know that somebody's got an interest in that automobile or that piece of equipment or whatever it may be.
Okay, Ken, if I understand it, again, I may confuse the daylights out of you, but myself too. But as it applies to an individual, the filing, perfecting a statement would be where that individual is located,
where
they're
reside.
Actually residing or living. But people do move around from time to time, and mm-hmm. collateral can move around from time to time. Have you guys talked about how you repossess this stuff? How do you actually keep track of where the collateral is?
Well, that's you know, that's a practical problem that is with us now and will continue to be with us. The only way that you could really put a stop to that kind of problem is to stop the freedom of movement in this country, and there's nothing in here that does that.
But Article 9 doesn't change anything.
No, Article 9 doesn't change that, but there are provisions, and there are provisions in current Article 9 on what, if any, steps a creditor has to take when the collateral or the debtor moves from one jurisdiction to another jurisdiction. I think one of the reasons it took NCUSL so long to get through the drafting process is because those can be very complex problems. And the latter parts of this section or of this bill deal pretty effectively, I think, with when you have to be concerned about a movement of the debtor from one jurisdiction to another.
Just out of curiosity, that's kind of out of the wind question, but oftentimes government records are not accurate. I'm just wondering, do they audit financing statements and those filings within the Secretary of State's office to determine whether or not they continue to be good or they should have been purged? Or
I'm sure they do have audit programs for doing that. I think the observation that most people who deal in this would make is that over the last 40 years since Article 9 first came into play, things have gotten much, much more accurate. And as the technology has improved, even with the tremendous increase in the volume of number of records, the speed with which information can be retrieved and the accuracy of the information is really quite exceptional. And Professor, you might want to comment on that too, but I think as a practical matter, that is really not accuracy of information or completeness of information in these files has not been a problem that has plagued the business community that's trying to make these credit decisions.
If I could just add, Chairman Minnis, the Secretary of State's operations under the current version of Article 9 are already very good, very sound. The move in SB 171 to allowing electronic filing is going to only allow improvements in that score because, of course, computer manipulation of all of these filings is easier and more efficient. Regarding purging, financing statements automatically expire after 5 years unless the lender takes affirmative steps to renew them. So they go away by themselves. The effectiveness goes away. Moreover, let's say you have a loan that's paid off in 3 years, and the borrower might not want that financing statement still hanging around for the extra 2 years. Well, the secured creditor has an obligation under this bill to file a termination statement to, in effect, bring an early life.
Do we know if that's happening as it's supposed to, or do we ever audit that?
I haven't looked into that. There are penalties. One of the nice improvements for small borrowers in SB 171 is that it provides penalties under some circumstances for creditors that don't live up to that obligation. So the borrower is able to make a demand, and if the demand isn't complied with, then the penalty is going to affect.
Okay, good. Everybody sufficiently?
Could I just?
More confused? Senator Courtney?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. In reference to a question put to you by Senator Beyer and Senator Duncan's here also, that the whole e-government thing, this whole internet thing, is the operative language to make sure that that's all in here? Because that's significant since 6173 on page 4, lines 43 and 44. Is that the magic line language that signals a recognition of where we are today and how we communicate and correspond, which we didn't do in 73 and 70? Are those the magic words?
Electronic chattel paper?
Yes.
Is that what you're referring to?
Yeah, I'm specifically referring, yes, Council Chairman, to lines. You're going to embarrass me again. I like to not wear these unless I have to. It's a vanity thing. 43 and 44, Learned and High Council.
Page 4.
Yeah, let me try it again.
Sorry.
Folks, page, let's do it this way, clearly. Senate Bill 171, page 4, Council, Learned and High Council's Professor of All Law. Lines 43 and 44, I let them speak. Those are the lines I'm referring to.
Right.
Those lines define something called electronic chattel paper. And
yes.
Chattel paper is a kind of property. It's one of those intangible personal property that I mentioned at the beginning of my testimony. It is a combination of an obligation that one owes and some security for that obligation. And that package together is called chattel paper. Traditionally, that has been in paper form, and that's why they call it chattel paper. But now, with the new technology, there's this thing which Article 9 chooses to define called electronic or paperless chattel paper. And this is simply providing a definition, because this is something, this paperless chattel paper is now being used as collateral in business transactions, and the code is simply catching up to the realities of the new technology. It is a pretty good example of the electronic revolution that this code is trying to keep up with. Yes, sir.
Senator Courtney.
Council. Thank you, Council. That was enlightening. So I can assume, Council, that those are the magic words that recognize the Internet and where we're at. Those are the words, or is there other, are there other magic words in here, or is there another operative section or phrase that does it, or is it throughout the document? I have not read this document. I am not going to read this document. And I say that as an attorney. Although the words, are there many words?
There are many other words. This is a good example of the words that we're talking about. These,
okay.
There are lots of places throughout this that talk about electronic this and that. Electronic chattel paper is one example.
Yeah. I'm just trying to help the individual who carries the bill on the Senate floor. That's all I'm trying to do here, Mr. Chair. That's what I'm afraid of. That's what I'm really... I just see it coming. I see this coming.
Mr. Chair.
Mr. Chair. Are you done?
I'm through. Yeah.
As the Chair of the Information Management Technology, I'd like to be sure that my Vice Chair does read through this and identifies all those items so we can deal with it.
Okay.
Before we move on, Chairman Minister, I'd like to just add one thought on the electronic environment. As Ken mentioned, that there are electronic provisions throughout SB 171, generally pretty specific. For example, in Part 5 of the bill are provisions that make sure to allow the filing of a financing statement to be done electronically. In general, the electronic provisions that we have in this bill are just confined to the mechanics of making a loan, giving collateral for the loan, recording the evidence, and so on. And of course, as the electronic age overtakes us, there are all sorts of other aspects of law that need to be thought about and updated. There are other uniform statutes that are at various places in the pipeline that do this, such as the Uniform Electronic Transactions Act. Article 9 does not it takes care of the electronic aspects of its own turf and no more.
Okay. Senator Harper.
Does this, since we only revise this every 40 years, does this leave us a broad enough definition for a new technology we can accommodate that without major revisions? Or
I thought about that a little bit. In fact, the last paragraph of my prepared testimony speaks a little to that, and I think essentially what I said is I don't expect this to last through the next century or even the next 40 years. With the way technology is moving ever more rapidly, I think we'd be very well served if we could stick with this fundamental set of rules for the next 10 years. But there are things in this bill that didn't exist even in imagination when the drafting committee started working on this bill.
follow up.
Go ahead, sir.
Yeah, that's my concern, that we don't hold back the system.
The worst way to do that would be to not pass this bill.
Moreover, Senator Harper, while NACUSL and the ALI were drafting this, and as they've been revising other aspects of the Uniform Commercial Code, this idea of change in technology outstripping what lawmakers can stay abreast of has been in people's minds. That's an excellent point. What we have tried to do is draft the electronic aspects of this bill in a way that we call medium neutral, so that not only is writing okay, and not only is email okay, and not only is whatever they have today okay, but it's written in as broad terms as possible, so that the innovations next year or 10 years from now would also fall within it. For example, if you're interested, I would point you to the definitions of record and of I have different pages, but in the very first few pages of the bill, there's a definition of record, a definition of authenticate, and those are basically modern age equivalents of the idea of a writing and assigned writing. And we've written these ideas, these electronic substitutes for writing or signing, as broadly as possible.
Thank you.
Actually, I think you raised some pretty interesting issues, and I was just kind of wondering if the work group really thought about this. The language we have in this document, is this from the national model, or is it something that
99.5% is from the national
model? So we're talking about electronic filings and electronic chattel paper. That is a term being used by this national.
Yes,
exactly.
Okay. So the question, I guess, comes up in my mind as to whether or not we could benefit by having another section or an additional definition that goes to the extent of defining other mediums. Similar, we go to the wiretap statutes, you know, we talk about wire and telephones and, you know, all kinds of ethereal stuff. I don't know if it's necessary to talk about that here or not. The idea being that you don't have to come back every session and say, gee whiz, we forgot this particular medium, and some lawyer somewhere,
right,
you know, takes issue with something. You know,
if I may, Senator, I don't believe that we'll be faced with that task, even without adding the additional language you're suggesting, because of the way it's written. It's written in a flexible enough way so that it won't box us in for future innovations. Now, of course, we can never know today whether we've thought of everything in the future, but we've consciously already recognized that there will be future innovations and have tried to avoid ourselves being boxed in.
Okay. Any other questions? Concerns? Senator Burdick.
Yeah, you mentioned the drafting work that you've done several times, and I guess I'm a little unclear. If this is based on a national model, how much actual drafting did you have to do? Was it extensive?
Well, no. In one sense, it was not very extensive at all, and Doug McKean, who's from the Legislative Council's office, is sitting back there, and he's probably about ready to throw a knife at me because he worked very hard on this. But why I say no is because, as the professor said, virtually every word in this comes out of the uniform draft. In some cases, the draft actually gave us alternative sections. They said, well, you can do it this way or you can do it that way. And so we had to go through, and in each of those, we had to choose one of those alternatives. A lot of the drafting had to do with changes that were required to effectively fit this big piece of legislation into existing Oregon law, because it's just like a heart transplant. You've got thousands of other things to connect it up to. And so that took an enormous amount of time. And then there were a few places, and I'm going to get into those into my testimony, where we actually ran into issues that were kind of specific to Oregon that didn't reverberate the same way in other states, and so we had to deal with those. But I think everybody on the committee needs to really understand that virtually every word in this bill is out of the uniform draft. And that was really important to us, maintaining that degree of uniformity as to the basic thrust of this is what allows Oregon to play in an interstate market in commerce. When a bank in Colorado or New York wants to make a loan to a business or a consumer here in Oregon, they've got to have some certainty as to what law they're dealing with, and they need to know that the rules of Article 9 work essentially the same way in every location. So So we didn't deviate from that, and I hope that's reassuring to the committee.
The reason for my question is when we get a bill this complex and huge, my concern is that through some mistake in drafting, or maybe when you're hooking it up to all the veins and arteries in your heart transplant metaphor, that we might miss something. And we've had some cases that are now causing us a lot of heartburn and employee overtime, et cetera. I just wouldn't want us playing on a national stage to have something like that happen. What can you say to address that?
Two things that I would say, Senator Burdick, about that. First of all, you know, this bill first came out for introduction to the states in 1998. Our first shot at this would have been in 99. We took a look at it and we said, that's too quick. We need some time to really study this and to get a broad-based group of people together to make sure that we're making all those connections, we're not missing anything. So we didn't go in 99. That puts our back to the wall now in 2001, but I'd rather be where we are knowing that we've taken a good hard look at this. And I'll tell you, we've also had the experience of 27 other states that have adopted this in their own legislature. And in that process, over the last year alone, I think the national conference has spent 10 years drafting this thing, issued no less than 6 sets of revisions based upon the feedback that they were getting from those 27 states. So we feel that this has had an additional process of buffing it into shape that we've benefited from. And the other thing I'd say is what Susan was talking about, this work group. We've all been on committees that don't function very well and where you spend a lot of time plowing the same ground. I think it's fair to say this committee worked extremely well, had a very positive, collaborative attitude about this, and I think the result is that we came to good decisions and we had 30 pretty sharp people looking at this thing trying to figure out all of the problems that we could identify. And so I won't guarantee you that we didn't miss something, and we may be back here in 2003 with egg on our face, or maybe even the latter part of this session if it goes fast enough, saying, well, we got to fix this and that. But I think we've done, with something this complex, about as thorough a job as our process will allow. And I just hope it's enough. But I share your concern.
I wanted to second what Ken said about the excellent and productive work of the Oregon State Bar Workers Group, and to thank Susan for running it that way. And to stress what Ken mentioned about us profiting from the 27 states that have already gone through this process. As I mentioned, I'm a member of the Uniform Commercial Code Committee of the American Bar Association, and at the meetings of that group, I've been in touch with people who count my counterparts throughout the nation. We've talked about the particular ways of plugging in the statute into our own statutes. Even though each state's bodies of law are different, there are certain standard points that you need to worry about, certain standard problems, certain kinds of things, and we actively confer. As a matter of fact, there's even a formalized version of that kind of conferring. There's something called the Joint Task Force on Enactment of Uniform Commercial Code Article 9. It's run partly by the American Bar Association's UCC committee, and also by something I believe, I might get this wrong, but I think it's the American College of Finance Lawyers, something like that. And its job is to disseminate information about just how to make these connections that Ken is talking about. Susan?
Chairman, if members of the committee, Tom Rosch from the Secretary of State's office did want to make sure you realized, he wanted to reassure the committee that the draft has been, the language in the draft has been modified enough to make sure that all media, all different forms of media can be used. So the development of technology and the changes will not affect the ability and usefulness of this act. And the different bills that are coming up with respect to UETA and UCETA, the electronic transactions, defer to UCC Article 9 and the language in there. So that will not present a problem.
Ever and ever.
We hope.
Ken, you said something about egg on your face several months down the road. How are we going to know if we have egg on our face? I mean, how's that going to happen? Just give me a hypothetical.
I think what would happen is that there would just be an unintended consequence in some transaction.
Bill Sizemore says that a lot. So, Bill Sizemore says that a lot. So, tell me about that. My ears perk up. Unintended consequence.
Well, I think in terms of where something is filed, or you know, what it takes to figure out where to file something. I mean, I think it's like a new set of clothes. You can admire it, and you can say, yeah, that's the right size, and you can do all this other stuff. But until you put it on and walk around in it for a while, you really don't know if it absolutely is a perfect fit. Again, I think having the advantage of the 27 that have gone before is very useful to us, and hopefully we'll result in the minimum of any problems.
Okay, now the Secretary of State's office was obviously consulted and spoken to.
They were part of the work group all the way through.
The Department of Motor Vehicles? Was there a need to have them here? Is there a...
I'm sorry?
The Department of Motor Vehicles. Any change to them in terms of title transactions, things like that?
Not really. I mean, there's one change that I can think of off the top of my head is there's this new thing that called a transition statement, remember, a transfer statement that can be used to assist in the transfer of title to a titled vehicle. That's provided for in here. Paul Cosgrove is here, and he can probably speak with more specificity to the impact of this on DMV. But basically, the mechanism of perfecting a security interest in a titled vehicle is just the same under the current code as it is under the new.
As a matter of fact, actually, what Article 9 currently does and what SB 171 continues to do is simply step out of the way and leave to other law, leave to the Motor Vehicle Code, the question of how do you perfect a security interest in motor vehicles. So that shouldn't present a problem.
All right, Senator Metzger.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Along those lines, you brought up an instance there, and I was thinking what Senator Harper said about making sure that with modern technology we can keep up to date. And I'm not certifiably smart in all this either, but I was interested in your comments regarding that, because I did have an instance of that, Mr. Chairman. And maybe under this code you could explain me how this would work. Or had an incident. As you know, in the last couple of years, for the first time, we've had title loan companies that just sprout up in the state of Oregon we didn't have before, in which an individual went to a title loan company, provided the title, instantly got cash. But the title loan, because it is short-term, was not being perfected. They just hold the title in their drawer. And they went down the street to sell the car then to a unsuspecting car dealer. Now, the car dealer, being very smart, didn't just sell it. They called DMV, found out it was owned by this person, but there was no lien holder, waited 2 days and called back again. There was no lien holder, sold the car. And you can imagine what happened later when all of a sudden the title loan person demanded that was their car, and the car dealer said that was their car, but it had not been perfected. And yet the title loan people, because of the nature of their business, don't perfect titles because of the time frame.
Well, maybe we should make them do it.
Yeah, so what? How would that be covered in this, and in solving that problem to make sure that, all parties involved, are not basically screwed? For lack of a better term.
For lack of a better term,
I'm sorry.
Legal term?
Yeah, that's my legal term, I guess.
Well, under both the current rules and the new Article 9, I think the result is the same. And if I followed your example correctly, the person who sold the vehicle should never have done so without getting the certificate of title from the owner of the vehicle.
And the person who bought the vehicle.
Yeah.
Well, they applied for lost title, you see, because they had checked and said, and so they said, well, they will just apply for a lost. They claimed they had lost the title.
I see. Right.
And they had checked with DMV, and they said it was clear, there was no liens, it was okay, file a lost title,
Article
and go ahead with the transaction.
Will not respond to that problem. It doesn't change the rules on that.
On what you're raising is a longstanding problem in general with certificate of title systems in general. You have this magic piece of paper that represents the rights to the car, and people can lie and say it was lost. People can go to the offices in two or three or five different states and get duplicate titles covering the same vehicle, sell the same vehicle five times, right? And that's a way of defrauding even a buyer who, as Ken suggests, is properly careful and insists on getting that title. You can hand them one that shows no.
But who's first in line? The title loan company who didn't perfect, or the unsuspecting car dealer who thought they were following the rules?
Let's see here. I would want to double check what the rules say. I'm not sure, Ken, if you're.
I'm glad he's the professional.
There are provisions, Senator Metzger, for governing priority of various interests in all collateral, including vehicles. In general, boy, I would think that the title. I shouldn't speak.
I think this is one of those egg on our face things. I think Senator Metzger raises a good point, because this doesn't deal with the car title loan companies. Saying that they're required to somehow.
That's true. That's true. And
now, maybe we ought to, and I think that's a good point in terms of technology or new business ideas. Somebody's taking a title to a vehicle, or it could be a boat or whatever else, and they're right. Saying, well, give me some money for this. Usually there's a contract of some sort that says, I'm going to pay you so much money per month until, you know, I've completed the contract, and then I get my property back. They haven't sold it, but I think you're suggesting that this title loan company then decided, I don't know whether they decided in default or whatever, but they went to sell the collateral, and there was a contest over. But if there was a filing with DMV that said, I'm a title loan company, I've taken this title
right.
as collateral on a loan, and then there was just a filing with DMV saying that we've done so, then the car dealer could simply check with DMV and find out whether or not there's some kind of a filing that says we've loaned money on this title.
I would hope that in this electronic age that very shortly we could move to an electronic system of certificates of title, and so that communication of all of this stuff would be.
We don't have to do that. We can just. I mean, what would be wrong with an electronic filing to DMV saying that XYZ Title Loan Company just loaned money on this title?
Exactly.
With the DMV.
Yeah. And then. Well, they got fax machines, for God's sakes, and file cabinets, and employees.
Yeah,
I think that gets to, Mr. Chairman, what Senator Harper was saying, that with technology today, we can do a lot of things, and I don't know, Mr. Chairman, as a police officer, I know if you're looking for something, you can notify and right away on a certain license plate or a car that is hot, you can notify. I mean, wouldn't there be some way in which, if you're a title loan company, you could somehow notify that a red flag, that there is a pending transaction or something, so that...
These guys are watching their bill. I'm going to go down a flame of fire here. That's not happening, by the way. This is kind of brainstorming up here. So, but I think Senator Metzger's got a good point here. And if there's a way to resolve that issue, it would be nice to do that.
But not in this bill.
Oh, maybe in this bill.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Metzger, that is actually an application of the Title IX rules generally. If you take a security interest,
You need to identify.
I'm sorry, Paul Cosgrove, pardon me, representing the Oregon Financial Service Association. If you take a security interest and don't perfect it, either by filing your financing statement or noting your interest on the certificate of title, you will lose to someone who later gains an interest in the car, in your example, who takes it without knowledge that you have that interest. If the car dealer knew that the title lender had made a loan, then the title lender wins. But if the car lender did not have actual notice and it wasn't noted on the certificate of title, the dealer should win. I believe the Motor Vehicle Code currently has a positive duty to file new notations of security interests on car titles, but there's a delay period, mm-hmm. and some of that delay period is actually necessary in a typical lending transaction where if you went to refinance your car, not a title loan, but just a regular loan, the title has to come back from bank one and then go into DMV for bank two. And so I think the delay period allowed under the current statute is 10 days to account for the fact that the piece of paper has to come back through several steps before it gets to DMV. Clearly, I think you're right with technology, that delay period ought to be able to be shortened. But I think in your example, the title lender should lose and the car dealer who took without any knowledge of this should win.
But on a $500 car, everybody's out.
Yeah.
Okay. Don't worry about that last conversation. We're just talking here. Don't
jail. Put the guy in jail and keep him from having children.
That is another alternative, isn't it? Okay. Anybody else have anything else to say about this?
Well, I do have a few more comments to make. I'd gotten to that point in my testimony where I said that I would talk about some of the changes that the work group came up with, right, with respect to the revised draft, and I'd like to spend just a few minutes on those. And again,
Ken, you don't have a matrix that shows the old Title IX UCC, the proposal, and then the variations?
Actually, Doug McKean has something kind of like that in his, I think he calls it the roadmap, that we can provide to you that might be helpful. Also, in the uniform draft, there is a side-by-side comparison of section. In other words, what section went where, because most of the sections that are in the new Article 9 are in the old Article 9 in some different form.
So who's got the roadmap?
I think Maryland has a roadmap.
Oh, Maryland's there. Look at this.
Maryland's got a lot.
Okay, we need to make copies of the roadmap for all of us. You don't want to know? Peter wants to know. Peter wants to know.
Okay.
Go ahead, sir.
Thank you. I mentioned that there were a handful of areas where the work group concluded to take a different direction in some respect than the uniform draft. I want to emphasize that those changes were very carefully considered and that they were agreed to by consensus of the work group, and that to me was the value of having this broad-based group of people who are representing all of these diverse interests. The first effort, or first area, that we took a different tack has to do with agricultural liens. One of the ways in which the revised Article 9 expands the scope is that for the first time it covers what it defines as agricultural liens, and that is a lien given by typically or that accrues to someone who has advanced either materials or services to a farmer on a credit basis. And we have various agricultural liens in our ORS Chapter 87, and we have some unique rules in our Chapter 87 that, as we looked at them and we tried to figure out how to meld them into revised Article 9 with all that that would mean in terms of perfecting those liens and so forth, we decided that it would be very controversial to go there, that we didn't want to bog our passage of Article 9 down in doing that, and we talked with one of the representatives who actually sat on the drafting committee with Nkuzel, and he said, well, for heaven's sakes, why don't you just redefine our agricultural liens so as to define out that type of an agricultural lien. So that is the approach that we used, and it's spoken to in my testimony that you have a copy of, and I think that's a good change. It's not a change that made the members of the lending community particularly happy, but we felt that it was more important to get Article 9 passed and that it was perfectly acceptable to do that in leaving the status quo in place with respect to agricultural liens. So that's one area of change. A second area of change that we incorporated into our draft involves the responsibilities that are imposed on the filing offices, and I said earlier in my testimony that most of the filing is done through the Secretary of State's office. We have centralized filing of financing statements, but there are some kinds of collateral, such as fixtures, that's personal property that is permanently attached to real property, where you're taking a security interest in a fixture. You do so not by filing with the Secretary of State, but by filing with the recording officer in the county where the real property records for that piece of land would be recorded. We dealt with both the Secretary of State's office and with the county clerks, and they sat on this work group all the way through the process to make sure that the filing provisions that are set out in the new revised Article 9 will work for them, that they can comply with them. And so we made some changes to satisfy their concerns. We lengthened some of the time limits that are set out in those filing provisions as to how long the Secretary of State or the county filing officer has to accomplish certain things in the filing process. I think that was the main... Oh, one other very important non-uniform provision that we have in our current Article 9. Professor Beer mentioned that when you file a financing statement against my piece of equipment, that gives you a 5-year hold on that piece of equipment. Of course, if I pay you off sooner, then you've got to terminate it. But it runs out of its own accord at the end of 5 years. Our Oregon law now says that 6 months before that 5-year period ends, the Secretary of State is going to send me a notice as the creditor saying, your financing statement's about to run out. It's a reminder. And I think the Oregon State Bar got that put in there several years ago because this 5-year thing is kind of a trap for the unwary. And it's a great creator of malpractice problems for lawyers. So we stuck this into the code. Well, has not been a part of the uniform version of Article 9 forever. And the Secretary of State didn't like the liability and the expense of continuing that. And so after considerable discussions involving members of the bar and the Secretary of State's office, we decided to take that out, to phase that out, so that it will not apply to financing statements that are filed subsequent to the effective date of this act. It will continue to apply to financing statements that are filed up to that effective date under old Article 9. So that's another...
Yes. Senator Duncan.
Sure. I wonder if you could explain with the problems that existed with it. Did they fail to send those out occasionally, and then they felt they were...
I don't remember them saying, Senator Duncan, that they had any particular problems with them or that they had any reservoir of cases where they'd failed to send the notice, but they had this concern. There was this liability, and it wasn't really clear to them what kind of liability they might have if they failed to send this out. And there's an expense involved in tracking it.
Mm-hmm.
So they just wanted to get rid of that. And if it had been a part of the Uniform Act that require those reminder notices, I think it would still be in here. But since it wasn't a part of the Uniform Act, and every other state apparently doesn't have that, we felt that the Secretary of State probably had a pretty good argument for taking that out. Let's see. Our current Article 9 contains a non-uniform provision. Oh, that's the one I just talked about. I'm sorry. The work group also spent a good deal of time discussing provisions in the draft that pertain to the rights and remedies of debtors in consumer transactions. At least one state looked at the new consumer provisions that I described a few minutes ago and just dumped all of them, didn't include any of them in their draft. Most of the states have looked at them, modified them in some places and not in others. We did the same thing. We took a look at those. We did make some minor modifications, but we left most of those consumer provisions alone. We provided that the new statutory damages that I'd mentioned, the $500 damages for violating certain provisions of Part 6 of the default provisions of Article 9 are only recoverable through individual actions. Uniform draft was silent on that point. We retained Oregon's existing rule on minimum damages in consumer cases. That currently provides for minimum damages of $350. We raised that to $1,000 in minimum damages. With respect to a consumer debtor's right to recover statutory damages where the secured party has filed an unauthorized record, and that would happen usually inadvertently where a creditor in filing a financing statement has gone beyond the terms of the security agreement in listing the types of collateral that are covered, and so they've listed something that is not covered by the security agreement. The uniform draft says, bingo, that's a $500 statutory penalty to the creditor. Our draft says that happens only if the debtor says, hey, wait a minute, you overextended on that filing and asked that an amended filing be made removing the security the effect of the financing statement, and the creditor fails to do that within a 10-day period. Let's see, another change made in the uniform draft by the work group concerns accessions. Susan mentioned this briefly. This is where, for example, new tires are installed on an automobile. If you've got one secured party that has a security interest in the tires and a second secured party has a security interest in the vehicle, then the debtor defaults. The question is which security interest in the tires is going to prevail. Under the uniform draft, the holder of the security interest in the vehicle is going to win. That is a departure from current Oregon law. and the work group decided not to follow that departure. They decided to stick with the current law, at least where the security interest involves interest in the tires is what we call a purchase money security interest. That is a security interest that was given to secure the payment of the purchase price for the tires. In that case, our draft provides that the security interest in the tires is going to win out over the competing security interest in the vehicle. One other
Why did we do this?
Mm-hmm. Well, we had a good, lively discussion with representatives of the retail tire industry who came in and said, it's not broken. We have, and in fact, the way our rule is now is the same way it is under a uniform Article 9, the old version. And for reasons that were not very clear to us, the drafters decided to change this rule with regard to purchase money security interests in accessions to titled property, such as automobiles. And we simply couldn't see a good reason to depart from it. The lenders looked at it. Typically, the folks that I represent would probably like to have the new rule. But we looked at this in terms of how do we balance the equities here and decided to stick with the current rule.
Okay.
I started to mention one other miscellaneous issue on which the work group considered but ultimately did not adopt a non-uniform change. Has to do with the impact of Article 9 on financing governmental transactions, such as bond, municipal bond issues. One of the ways that the uniform folks revised Article 9 and made it broader in its coverage than the current Article 9 is that the present law very broadly excludes these so-called governmental financing transactions from Article 9. Whereas the new code provides that Article 9 will apply to such transactions unless you have another law in Oregon that expressly provides otherwise.
Can you give us an example of where that might happen?
Where that might happen?
Right. Give me a real-life instance.
Well, a municipality issues a new bond to finance some activity of the, and the question is, under what circumstances would they need to go through the Article 9 process to create a perfected security interest for the benefit of their bondholders? And right now, it's real clear under Oregon law that, and under the old uniform code, that they don't have to worry about Article 9 because it simply does not apply to that kind of transaction. It's less clear, frankly, in the new version. And what I started to say is, even though we have in this draft adhered to the language of the uniform, the new uniform draft, which we think, you know, is more selective, the bond council are likely to come in with a separate piece of legislation to address their concerns on that. So we thought in order to get to the table and get going with this bill, we would do what virtually every one of the other 27 states has done, which is to adopt the uniform version and then be willing to sit down with the bond council and see if we need to tinker with that as the legislative process goes on.
Was there someone from the treasurer's office or bond council listed in the group?
See, not the treasurer's office, but we had several representatives of law firms who are focused on bond work. They were the ones who were at the table on that issue.
Well, I'm just wondering, do I understand the current Article 9 doesn't require municipal bonds to comply with?
That's right.
And in the new provision, you're saying it may?
Well, what it says specifically, and Professor might want to help me out, but basically it says that Article 9 applies unless another Oregon law expressly provides otherwise. So one way that you can make sure that the status quo remains unchanged is to go through the other Oregon statutes and make sure that they expressly provide this kind of transaction is not subject to Article 9.
But I'm just wondering, is it a good thing that Article 9 might apply? I mean, in the sense that you could, a municipality could perfect an interest in a piece of property in addition to, I mean, usually they have the good faith and credit of the city or they borrow the state's bond rating on the good faith and credit of the state. Is this like an additional amount of the insurance? Or
the overall Article 9 idea is that it's a good thing to provide notice to the world when a borrower's property is encumbered so that later lenders don't get fooled.
I'm just wondering if this goes to the extent of providing a little bit more security for bond counsel. terms of the issuance of bonds? Does it
I would say it provides security for, I suppose for some, under some circumstances, for bond counsel, yes, but certainly for other lenders to municipalities or other public organizations.
Well, one of the problems that the work group had in really coming to grips with this issue was recognizing that, you know, it's one thing when a city goes out with a bond issue, but that's not the only kind of credit transaction that a city might get involved with. They might engage in a very run-of-the-mill, ordinary transaction where they're buying a new fire truck and they're giving a security interest in that. And we weren't comfortable saying that in that sort of transaction, Article 9 had no applicability. And
But it makes sense. I assume if you were going to assess the financial stability of a municipality, if there were certain filings on items encumbered, at least that would give you a clearer picture of the creditworthiness, so to speak. Okay. Do we have more?
I do not. I appreciate very much your patience with us this afternoon, and obviously we're very anxious to promote the passage of this bill. We'll be happy to answer any questions.
Senator Metzger has one.
If I could ask one, Mr. Chair, I was interested in your Ascension's description in terms of the car and the tires. So just so I can understand this, since we're different and you're not making the change, would the same line of thinking be if I was a lender and I loaned you $35,000 for a very expensive jet sled, and then you went out and wanted a new trolling motor from Stevens Marine and you bought this trolling motor on time or whatever, that in the case of a default, the person, in this case, say Stevens Marine, would have first dibs on it because of the trolling motor and not me who had the titled boat? Is that, I mean,
it's a narrower
with the tire, yeah. With it's the tire car scenario here?
I think what Ken was about to say is that the motor seller would have first claim on the motor only, but probably would have no claim to the rest of the vehicle.
Okay.
You'd want to look and see what the agreement was, but probably the owner of the vehicle gives an interest in the motor to the motor seller, and that's it.
Okay.
Do we have any idea how often this kind of concept might be used? And you see these trucks running around with these, you know, huge lift kits and all this kind of stuff. And people, I mean, are they financing those? And would this apply? Could you actually finance the lift kit per se? And then there's a default, and then you have to disassemble the truck.
Yeah.
Give the lift kit to somebody else, the tires to somebody else, and the bank gets the frame and the body to the vehicle.
Yeah, I think that's possible.
Interesting.
Theoretically, I suppose so. I think in practice, it's extremely rare for any seller to go out and try to repossess one of these little accessions. It's much more common for a lender who has an interest in the whole vehicle to care about the vehicle. And even then, this is not the typical kind of property that gets repossessed.
Senator Burton.
Thank you. Could you describe again the disclosure that takes place in these scenarios? In other words, the person who has the whole vehicle as collateral, how does the disclosure work so that they know that they only have the car minus the tires worth of collateral?
Well, let's see. I suppose what would happen is the person with an interest in the whole vehicle, by the way, it's not just the frame and the radios and so on. It's the whole thing, including the tires. I mean, there's nothing that prevents two creditors each from having an interest in the same part of the thing.
There's no disclosure required.
Let's say a bank that gives a loan on the whole car would get its lien recorded on the certificate of title, as we were discussing with Senator Metzger, and that's publicized simply by virtue of anybody who, you know, wants to buy the car or lend against it is going to ask to see the title, and they'll see that name there. So that's there. Now, and then in terms of the interest in the part, I guess, let's see. Ordinarily, that gets publicized by filing of a financing statement against the borrower. It's one of these routine, publicly accessible
things. But that information would also go into title.
Does that set up a different problem if somebody goes out and they finance a set of tires, expensive tires and wheels from
some tire company, and they own the car, they turn around and sell the car, but don't pay off the tires, the person who purchased the car, there's a title of the car, but is there also a UCC filing on the tire someplace? And the owner of the tires can somehow track the car down and take the tires back. Can't leave again in the street on the frame.
You get into some funny hypotheticals. There's a more general principle that you ought to keep in the background, that maybe this raises different questions.
You can tell we're more into what ifs.
It partially solves your problem, but perhaps raises other questions. If you're talking about a car, the kinds of cars that you or I drive around and use for our own personal use, those are called consumer goods. And the tires on those cars would also be called consumer goods. And ordinarily, if the lender is taking a security interest in consumer goods to secure the price, a loan of the price of the stuff. In other words, you bought the tires from me on credit, and I'm keeping a security interest in the tires. There has never been any publicity of that security interest under Article 9. It's called automatic perfection. Current Article 9 allows automatic perfection of security interests in consumer goods. Revised Article 9 does not.
Automatic perfection just by what? By virtue
of the fact that the borrower and the lender have agreed.
Signed a contract.
Yes.
No filing with the Secretary of State's office.
That's right. And would we like to have information about everything? Certainly, but the decision made decades ago, and I don't think anybody has really seriously disagreed with it in the meantime, is that it costs a little bit of time and effort to give this publicity, and that in relatively small loans for consumer goods, that time and effort is probably outweighed. That the benefit from the information would be outweighed by the effort, not to mention the burden on the system at the Secretary of State's office, keeping track of every tire in the state.
Okay. Just out of curiosity, is there anybody out there that can't stand this bill? Or is they've got passionate dislike for some portion of it?
I think people would agree with me that there's been remarkable consensus on this. At the national stage, there were different interest groups that wanted to pull the tug of war one way or another, but at the end of that, there was consensus too, from the lending community, from the borrowers, from the consumer protection people, even the consumers union, the powerful consumers lobby actively participated in the entire process, and at the end was able to say that they had no objections to it.
Okay. Is there any additional notice to consumers when they sign a contract, or in addition to what's currently under Article 9?
Well, let's see.
There are no additional notices that I can think of, Mr. Chairman, at the time of signing a contract, but there are additional notifications that I mentioned in my testimony, such as information about the right to receive a surplus and the liability for deficiency, the manner of calculation of that. And I think there are one or two others that I'm not pulling up right now that come up in that default process.
You know, you're reminding me that there is one additional set of protections in SB 171 at the time of setting up the deal, and that is it's ordinarily the contract between the borrower and the lender that spells out what the collateral is. And SB 171 requires that when the borrower is a consumer, there be a certain greater amount of specificity in stating what the collateral is. You're not allowed to use just large generic catch-alls, all of your personal property, all of your bank accounts, for instance. So the fear is people might not really pay attention to a general, that sounds dramatic when I say it this way.
Everything in your house, right? Located at
your children.
The thought is that when there's greater specificity, that A, alerts the borrower to exactly what they are potentially giving up, and B, it also requires the lender to focus only on collateral that they're really interested in. It's so easy for a lender to say, give me everything, whether they really care about it or not. But if we require the lender to be a little more specific, that means they're taking only collateral that they care about.
Okay. Well, we'll be back with this on Wednesday. Any additional comments? Questions? All right. Thank you very much, and we're adjourned.
Thank you.